Everyone knows that after the terrible, unspeakable tragedy of the Holocaust, the survivors, Baruch Hashem, were able to move on with their lives, and many built beautiful families that are the pride and joy of the Jewish people to this day. And we continue with the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to build from the ashes of the Holocaust. So for the most part, we were just extremely happy and grateful that people were able to survive altogether after the horrors of the gas chambers and the concentration camps. But one issue that is clearly flagged in the aftermath of the Holocaust is that the women who were in the concentration camps, who were subject to the domain of the Nazis, of the Germans, were quite possibly in the category of what we call shvuyos, captive women, according to halacha. And there is a sugya rucha, there's a long sugya in towards the second parak, the end of the second parak of Ksuvos, and it appears throughout Shas in various places, that a shvuya, a captive woman, is prohibited from marrying a Kohen. Now, in a number of the cases, the women were married to Kohanim, and they were able to reunite after the war and continue with their marriage. In other cases, the women were single at the time of the Holocaust, and maybe they were married and lost their husbands, and then they married afterwards Kohanim, to whom they had not previously been married. So does this present any type of a problem from the standpoint of halacha? Does not appear that any woman was prohibited from staying with her husband who was a Kohen. Does not appear that any woman was prohibited from marrying a Kohen if the woman had survived the Holocaust. So to what degree did the poskim focus upon this? The poskim did focus upon this. There are tshuvas about this in the aftermath of the Holocaust. There were Bati Din who didn't even necessarily publish tshuvas, but who dealt with this issue. It's referenced in a number of places if you look for it. There's a tshuva by Rav Yaakov Reish in the Chilkos Yaakov Siman Mem, two tshuvas in the Minchas Yitzchak by Rav Yitzchak Dayan Weiss, in the Chelek Aleph of his tshuvas, Siman Pei Zayin and Pei Ches, so tshuva in the Mishnah Halachos by Rav Menashe Klein, Chelek Kei, Siman Reish Tez Zayin, so tshuva by the Satmar Rebbe in the Divrei Yoel, Evin Ezer, Siman Yud Ches, and a smattering of other tshuvos that we were able to locate and other discussions regarding this issue in which they all discuss this point. Now, the Mishnayos and the Gemaras talk about really three different types of cases of a captive woman. One is the woman who's taken captive by terrorists who are keeping her at bay to use for their own purposes, whether they're planning to rape her or to violate her or to use her to work for them, what we call an isha shibuya, regular captive woman. The second case is isha shenechbisha, a woman who's taken as ransom, machmas mamun or machmas nefasha. She's taken a ransom either because there's money that's that the captive. When we say machmas mamun, it doesn't mean in the way that you might think that they want to get money for taking the woman captive. It means that there's money that they feel is owed to them, and in order to be able to receive the money that's owed to them, they take a woman, Jewish woman, captive. Or they take a woman captive, machmas nefashos, otherwise they're going to kill somebody. And the third type of case is where there's a group of bandits or even a government that ransacks a city and they besiege the city. That's what we call Ir Shekabshua Karkum, and they take control of everything and everybody who is in the city, where the halacha is that all the women are presumed to be defiled. There's a question as to whether it's only if it's a different government or the same government, and whether it's any group of officials or soldiers who would take over a city. But the concern over there is that if they have a free latitude to do whatever they want, then they're going to violate the women. Unless, we're told, there's a machbua, there's a little crevice or hiding place where the women might be able to go, even if it's only big enough to hide one woman, so you can be makel that any particular woman could be presumed to have hidden in that particular place, if she asserts Tahora Ani, that she was not violated. But otherwise, we say that even if a woman asserts that she was not violated, if she's a shibuya, she would still be a suur to a kohen. We do have a principle that appears throughout Shas, the bishbuya hekilu, that there are all kinds of kulos, that we allow even somebody who's otherwise pasul eidus to testify that a woman was not violated. So we see that the mere fact that a woman is a captive by itself does not necessarily prohibit her definitively or conclusively, but it creates a presumption that she's a suur l'kohen, unless proven otherwise. It can be proven otherwise. Even with an eid echad, one witness comes along that she is tahora, then she's tahora. However, unlike a case of a woman who's missing her husband, where we have a similar principle of mishum aguna, kilu bei rabbanan, we do not have a dispensation for the woman herself to be ne'emenes. So if the woman herself says tahora ani, or her husband says she's tahora, that's not sufficient ne'emenes. It has to, even if her own shifcha says it, it's not considered to be sufficient ne'emenes. It has to be a third party. The third party could be somebody who's otherwise pasul le'edus, even a katan, who the Gemara in Baba Kama, Kuf Yudalet Amud Beis, talks about a katan who says, oh, when my mother was taken into captivity, I never left her side, and he just tells the story, matter-of-factly, Siach Lefitumo. So even that could have ne'emanus, so we do have a certain dispensation based on this principle of Bishvuya Hekilu, but the starting point is that she would be prohibited at least to a kohen. Now, the Rambam writes that the reason for the prohibition is for the simple understanding of the Gemaras, which is that she's a suffix zona. A kohen is not allowed to be married to a woman who engaged in relations with a non-Jew, with somebody who's puzzled to her. And since here we're talking about where there were non-Jews who took the woman captive, and there's a fear that they violated her. Remember, kohen is prohibited even if the woman was raped, even if she didn't engage in voluntary relations, he still is prohibited. That's why, for example, I'm a kohen. So my great-grandfather was married to a woman who was raped by Cossacks in Russia, and he killed the Cossack, found him in the act, killed the Cossack, ran away, he had to divorce his wife because she was raped by a non-Jew. He married somebody else. I come from the next wife. My grandfather was born to the following wife. But these things happen. So a kohen was not allowed to remain married to a woman who was raped. That would make her into a zona. So that's what the Rambam says, that she's considered to be a suffix zona. Now, a suffix zona, the Rambam says, because it's only a suffix zona, therefore there are leniencies because it's only a suffix. So, mita araisa, only something which is vaday is also. The Rambam is l'shitas, so the Rambam holds that when we say suffix to araisa, the chumrah, that's only a din d'rabbanan, according to the Rambam. So therefore, we start off with the assumption that it's only an issa d'rabbanan for kohen to marry a shvuya. That seems to be the simple understanding of all the Mishnayos, the Gemaras. It's an issa d'rabbanan. A kohen can't, just like it's an issa d'rabbanan, a kohen can't marry a chalutza. There are certain issa d'rabbanan. Shvuya is an issa d'rabbanan, then maybe she's a suritima on d'araisa level, but it's not of a vados. So therefore, it's only an issa d'rabbanan. Rashi, and Baba Kama Kuf Yudal and based on the Kuf Yudal and the short sugya over there indicates that maybe it could be, it's an issa d'araisa. It's a question whether Rashi would still hold that way in the maskan of the sugya. The sugya is talking about how a katan is not neman when it comes to d'araisas, and it tells the story. The katan who said, "I never left my mother's side," and he was believed. And the Gemara and Rashi says, "Oh, we see, even though this is a d'araisa." And then the Gemara concludes, no, Shvuya is different because b'shvuya hekilu rabbanon, that the Chachamim were very make when it comes to Shvuya. So a lot of Meforshim say, yeah, Rashi and the Havamina was assuming it's Daraisa, but when the Gemara says b'shvuya hekilu, so that means that by the time we get to the Maskana, even Rashi is understanding that according to the Maskana, it's an Issa d'rabbanon. That's generally how it's assumed, not only an Issa d'rabbanon, but we call an Issa kal. The Maharik has a discussion in Shoresh Kuf Samech, in which he says that since we have a general principle that any shenanza, there's a suspected relationship, well, you don't know, but adults that a woman had a relationship, bein beratzon, bein me'ones, a woman is generally only asura, b'ayidei kinoi v'stira, she has to go through a hosota process So therefore, the fact that a shvuya is not allowed to marry a kohen is based on the principle of ma'ila osu b'yuchsin. That it's a special chumrah that we have with respect to kohanim. The Sefer Neman Shmuel, quoted in the Otzer HaPoskim at the beginning of Siman Zayin, also says that the Isser Shvuya is just a chumrah b'yalma. You find lashon like that in the Rashbam, in Baba Basra, on Kuf Lamed Hey, where the Rashbam says as follows. He says, the reason why we're mekel when it comes to shvuya to allow edim psulim, we also have another kula when it comes to shvuya than ir shekavshu akarkum, that even one machbua achas, one hiding place, you know, it rescues all the women, even though only one woman could have fit there. We also have the kula that once an aide comes along and testifies on the woman's behalf, and she's given a heter, even if edim come afterwards and would testify to take her out of her kula. We have a principle of pesha also pesha hitters. Let's say we don't know the woman was taken as a shvuya. So she's the one who tells us. And she says, I was taken as a shvuya, and it turns out that I was tahora. So we would say a pesha also a pesha hitters, she would be neman. What if afterwards, Adam come along and say, we know that she was a shvuya, so it's too late. Even if she hasn't already married, we say once she's given the heter stays. Despite the fact she didn't act upon the heter doesn't go away. So we have all of these kulos when it comes to shvuya. So Rashbam explains the stam isha mishamaris atzma miznus, that a regular that a woman generally protects herself from znus v'ukma cheskosa, and therefore since she was v'cheskas heter before and she stays v'cheskas heter, the iser kal who imnisays the kohen, it's considered to be an iser kal, it's considered to be a lower level iser. So the Neman Shmuel also has a similar lashon saying it's a chumrah bi'alma, but he goes further and he says therefore there's a mitzvah, and this was very important in the aftermath of the Holocaust. He says it's a mitzvah lechapes stadim lahakil, that one is supposed to go out of their way in order to find stadim, in order to find grounds for leniency. There's a question, let's say you didn't find grounds for leniency and the woman married a kohen. So do we say in this tetzei that she's obligated to get divorced? When it comes to other types of Yisurim, we say that a Grusha marries a Kohen, so a Mnissei states it. She marries a Kohen, he has to divorce her. Even a Chalutza, we say if she marries a Kohen, Mnissei says, a Safik Chalutza would make her. But a Chalutza as well, we say if she marries a Kohen, so a Mnissei states it, he's not allowed to remain married to her. So the Beis Shmuel assumes that the same halacha is true with respect to a shvuya. When it comes to a shvuya, we would say mnisseis teitzei, that we don't have a kula in that respect. If she was already married, as long as we didn't find a kula, then we don't allow her to stay married, which was also a concern with some women who got married after the Holocaust. And then the question was, they married to kohanim, are they allowed to remain married to the kohanim? So that again is part of what raises the level of intensity with respect to this particular shaila. Now, what we're assuming up until now is that the only problem is for a woman who was in the Holocaust to be married to a kohen, and we have to somehow get out of that issue. But what about her marrying a non-kohen? So we're assuming that's not a problem. But the truth is that's not so pashut either, because the Mishnah indicates towards the end of the second parak of Ksuvos that it was ayidei nefashos. If there was a threat of death, so then there, according to Rashi and Tosfos, not only would be the woman who was taken captive be a surah to her, to a kohen, but she would even be a surah to her husband who was a Yisrael. Why is that? Because if a woman is married to a man, this is only if she's married, but if she's married to a man and then she commits nus voluntarily with somebody else, Jew or non-Jew, so then she's a sota and she's not allowed to remain with her husband. So the fear is that if a woman is taken captive where she feels that if she has a relationship with her captor, then he's more likely to keep her alive, so then she might have a voluntary relationship with her captor, even though it's for the purpose of saving her life, but that's still considered to be voluntary if she initiates it, and so then she could be prohibited to her husband who's a Yisrael. The Gemara is not explicit about whether the Mishnah there is talking about only prohibiting her to a Kohen or even to a husband who's a Yisrael if she was taken captive ayidei nefashos, but the way Rashi and Tosfos understand the sugya is that she would be prohibited even to her husband who's a Yisrael, and the Shita of Rashi and Tosfos is quoted by the Ramah in Siman Zayin, Neven Ezer, which is the Siman that deals with all of the different halakhas relating to Shibuya. Now it happens that if you look in the Ran, on the sugya there in Ksuvos, the Ran quotes from the Gaonim, also the Shita of the Rambam as well, that's not the proper understanding of the sugi in their opinion. In their opinion, the woman, there's never a chash that she's going to have a voluntary relationship with her captor. There's only a chash of her having a being raped, of having a relationship under duress, and therefore she's certainly not going to be prohibited to her husband, who is not a Kohen. But the shita of the Machmirim of Rashi and Tosas is brought by the Ramah. There's a discussion in the Pesachei Tshuva about whether we should paskin this way. L'halacha, the Shus Yaakov says that we don't really paskin this way, but l'maisa, the Ramah paskins that way, so that also has to be taken into consideration. So let's focus first with respect to the question of whether all the women who served, who were survivors of the Holocaust, who reconnected with their husbands, are they allowed to remain with their husbands or not? So there were five different heterim that the poskim talk about. One is that maybe we don't paskin like the Rashi and Tosfos. Maybe the halacha we can be somech on the shita of the Rambam and the Gaonim, as the Birkei Yosef said. Second reason for leniency is that whenever there's a machlokis, the Beis Shmuel brings a klal and sifkot and yudches and simin zayin, that whenever there's a machlokis haposkim with respect to shvuya, so one application of b'shvuya hekivu, that we find leniencies when it comes to shvuya, is that whenever there's a machlokis haposkim with respect to a specific question, whether a shvuya would be prohibited or permitted in a particular instance, and some poskim say one way and some poskim say the other way, so whenever there's a machlokis de brabusa, whenever there's a machlokis haposkim, you could go lahakel. So here, since we know it's a machlokis haposkim, so there's room to go lahakel. Third reason is that why is it that Rashi and Tosfos say that you have to be worried if a woman is taken captive ayide nefashos? So what you have to be worried about is that she might decide to seduce her captor, so her captor would be more likely to keep her alive. That wasn't an option. It was not an option in this particular case where the Germans, where the Nazis were bent on killing everybody, whether they would have relationships with the women or not. They didn't take them captive just, you know, to keep them alive to have relationships. They'd have a relationship with a woman if they could, and then they'd kill the woman. So it wouldn't have saved the woman's life. There's a Tshuvas HaRosh in Klal Amid Beis of the Tshuvas HaRosh. The Rosh talks about where there were women who were taken captive for purposes of their being converted to a different religion, where the Rosh says you don't have to worry about the women engaging in a relationship with their captors because that wouldn't have saved them, since the objective of the captors was to kill them unless they would convert to a different faith. The only thing that would save their skin would be if they converted to a different religion, and therefore there was no chash that they would engage in voluntary relations with the captors, since that wouldn't save them anyway. So the Minchas Yitzchak talks about this, and he says the fact that the captors, the Nazis, would not be appeased through a voluntary relationship was something that they viewed as perhaps being even more harsh on these particular hostages. But he says, Elokim chashavo l'tova. He says that the fact that they had that mindset actually worked out well for the women who were at least married to non-Kohanim, that they took away the concern that they would engage in voluntary relations. And finally, and this is a very important consideration, the Trumas Hadeshin talks about the Gzeiras Ostreich. I guess it's Austria. There was a Gzeira that they were taking the women captive with the goal of having them forcibly converted to their religion. This happened in Austria. And the Gedolim at the time held that all of the women, those women who eventually came back to the fold, there were some women who refused to yield, some women did yield, didn't matter in the end. Everybody who came back, they didn't check their credentials, they didn't put them through a test as to whether they converted, they didn't convert, whether they yielded to the captors, didn't yield to the captors. Everyone who came back said, we're going to welcome you with open arms, you can go back to your husbands. You can go back to your husbands who are Yisraelim. Not only that, they said, you go back to your husbands who are Kohanim. This is brought by the Dalchei Moshe in Simen Zion Eben Ezer, and the big question, of course, is, how in the world could they be making for them to go back to the husbands who are Kohanim? It's the Yisraelim, so you could say, okay, we'll assume that they didn't engage in voluntary relations, but to go back to their husbands who are Kohanim, that's an even bigger question, so we'll get to that in a moment. However, based on the Ramah, gives the following explanation. The Ramah says that he thinks that in this case, that some of the women voluntarily went along, it seems like they may have engaged in voluntary relations, but nonetheless, says the Ramah, why is it that they were permitted to stay with the Kohanim? It must be the Chazal exercised a very rarely used authority of Afkiinun Rabban and the Kiddushin Mine. In this particular case, it said we're going to, we have this in very rare cases in the Gemara, usually when there was some sort of a prima facie get that was given, or there was some problem with the initial Kiddushin. In this case, it doesn't relate to being Mater Eishis Ishli Alma, so they were a little bit more lenient in terms of exercising the principle of Apkeinu Rabbanan the Kiddushin Minei, of saying we're going to nullify the marriage, therefore it was considered when the woman voluntarily had relations with a non-Jew, so she was doing it as a Penuya, and therefore she can marry, she can marry the man that she was previously married to, because she was never really married to him retroactively. She was considered to be a penuya when she had the relations with the non-Jew, and therefore she's allowed to marry the Yisrael after she came back from her hostage state, from her hostage condition. And then finally, the final consideration which is brought in the Aruch HaShulchan, Simen Zayin Sifa Chav Gimel, is that he says you can assume that our women are Nashim Tsenuos, since they're Nashim Tsenuos, like the Gemara beginning of Ksuvos talks about the Nashim Tsenuos who never allow themselves to be taken forcibly by terrorists or by gangsters, and therefore they would rather give themselves up lamisa than engage in a relationship, at least not a voluntary relationship. So at least as far as the Neshe Yisraelim are concerned, you can rely also upon the consideration of Nashim Tznua. So we have those five different considerations with respect to the women who were married to Yisraelim, that just like, and as far as the Neshe, the Gzeres Ostreich is concerned, that was a Harasha, says the Ramah. So the Holocaust also, he says, various poskim say, the Holocaust also should qualify as a harasha, given the enormity of the situation and the tremendous tragedy it would wreak on the Jewish people if we wouldn't allow the women to go back to the husbands. But what do we do with respect to the women who were married to Kohanim? There it's a little bit more difficult, because you have to worry about forcible rape. Also, as the Avnei Miluim points out, if you're going to rely upon the Gezeres Ostreich, it doesn't do any good to just eradicate the marriage and say that when the woman engaged in a relationship with a non-Jew, even if it was forcible rape, that she wasn't married at the time, Lamaisa, she still would be considered to be a Zona. She would still be prohibited from marrying a Kohen, even if it was not a voluntary relationship. So here the postman talk about four different types of situation. One situation is a woman who was in the concentration camps, which would be, you know, some sort of a classic Shibuya situation where everybody there was essentially a hostage. Second would be if they were in the ghettos or the cities that were besieged by the Nazis. That would be more an Ir Shekavshua Karkum type of situation, which lends itself more to the question of, was there a hiding place where a woman could have potentially gone? Third is, let's say a woman was taken, the Menchus Yitzchak has a case like this, that a woman was simply in a hospital facility where they weren't in a camp and they weren't in a ghetto, but they were under, they were nechbisha, they were under the control and the supervision of the non-Jewish authorities. And a fourth is a case where a woman was hiding out in the home of some non-Jewish family that was sheltering the woman, where there was a constant situation of yichud. So you'll say, wait a second, why are you throwing yichud into the picture? What does yichud have to do with shibuya? So there's a bahag that seems to equate yichud with shibuya, and says that any situation where there was yichud with a non-Jew also is considered to be shibuya. We have to worry that there may have been relations, and therefore a woman would be prohibited to a kohen. In fact, this emerges from a sugyan of Avodah Zarah, Daf Chof Gimel. There's a Mishnah over there that indicates that a woman should never be nisyachedes imen ove kohavim. And the Gemara asks that if yichud alone is prohibited, so why does the Mishnah indicate that if I had a woman who was taken captive for monetary purposes, so then she would still be considered to be permitted? Why is she still considered to be permitted if it's for monetary purposes? Because we assume that the captor does not want to lose the ability to collect their money, and therefore even an Ashes Kohen is going to be permitted to her husband under those circumstances if she was taken for monetary purposes, as long as Yad Yisrael Tekifa. So the question is, but why shouldn't we, but if she's, according to the Mishnah, if she was misyachedis at all with an Akum, then she should be a surah to her husband, because that's what the Mishnah indicates. So the Gemara answers, no, kan l'chatchila kan b'diyevet, that the Mishnah only means l'chatchila, she shouldn't do it, but b'diyevet, she'd be permitted to her husband, if it's not a case of nechbisha for nefashos purposes, for killing purposes. And the second answer that the Gemara gives is, well, maybe, the first answer is given by Ravina. The second answer that the Gemara gives is, no, maybe Nechbasha is better. Nechbasha is better than Yichud. Because if a woman's Nechbasha, because the non-Jew has some money to gain from the process, because they have some money they want to collect, they'll be more cautious with what they do around the woman, as opposed to if it's not a regular case of Yichud, so then you have to be more Machmir. So Tosa says, what are you talking about? Then every single woman that we have who's married to a Kohen is going to have to get a divorce. Because for business purposes or whatever, it happens from time to time. Tosfos assumes that women get involved in Yichud situations. When I'm a Jewish man, you know, you send and the carpenter comes over to do some work in the house, the plumber, whatever, they'll be from time to time. Yichud situations, inadvertent Yichud situations. So every woman's going to have to get divorced from according to the second teretz of the Gemara. So Tosfos gives two answers. One answer is that really the first answer of the Gemara, Kan l'chatchila kan d'yevid, is the correct answer, and therefore d'yevid, all of the women who are, if they only were in a Yichud situation, they're going to be permitted. And the second answer of Tosfos, which is more complicated, because the Beis Shmuel claims we pass like the second answer. The Chelkos Mekokin says we pass like the first answer, no problem. But the Beis Shmuel says in Siman Zayin, you have to, that we pass like the second answer. The second answer says you do have to worry about Yichud, but only in a case where the woman is Mesur Biyodo, where the person, even though he's not necessarily a captor, but he has the authority and the jurisdiction to be able to exercise control over the woman, so that even if she would scream out for help, she wouldn't be able to get help. So you could certainly see that in a situation during the Holocaust, if a woman was alone, even in someone's home, she's hiding, she wouldn't be able to scream out if she was subjugated. So that's the question. Do you need both conditions? Tosfos throws in three different things. You know, two of them, one of them, Derech Agav, he says, well, it's only, you know, Lizman Muat. He's talking about it's a short period of time. So Tosfos is Mako, when the woman's not Mesur B'yodin, when she's not subject to their control and jurisdiction, so does Tosfos require all three criteria? One, she's not Mesur B'yodin. Number two, that she would not be able to scream out. And number three, that was only for a short period of time. Or do we say, no, as long as she's not Mesur B'yodin, and even if she wouldn't have been able to scream out, or it's for a long period of time, maybe that would also be okay. So that's a machlokas as well, and all of this, you know, weighs into the calculation, or the calculus with respect to how these shilos get answered. So let's go through the different considerations that are discussed by the poskim. Number one, does the Gzeiros Ostreich, does the approach of the Darchei Moshe suggest that if the Avapkinim Rabbanim Kedushim Mineh, so does that work with respect to Neshei Kohanim? The Darchei Moshe himself says that they permitted even the Neshei Kohanim to return to their husbands. How could such a thing be? Could such a thing be true? If you look at the way in which this is codified in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Zayin Sif Yud Aleph, the Ramah does hear when he's mentioning that case. So Shas Zom Vehereg Rav Hitzir Rabosein Levala Yisrael. The Ramah only mentions Labala Yisrael. It's a little confusing because a little bit later down in the same sip, the Ramah indicates that there's a dispensation, even Labala Kohen, but the truth is that's a different case that he's talking about, where a woman was taken for purposes of a conversion, where the assumption is that if she converted right away, there wasn't enough time to rape her, and afterwards, if she already converted to the other religion, the laws of the jurisdiction of the people who raped her would dictate that once she's already their religion, they wouldn't be allowed to rape her anymore. So that's really talking about a very different case where the woman could save herself through conversion. However, when the Ramah is talking about this particular case, the Ramah says Labali Yisrael. So some say that the fact that the Ramah, the Darchei Moshe, says Afilu L'Kohanim, maybe that's a Tol Sofer, and even if it's not a Tol Sofer, it's not L'Halacha. And some say that no, there really is a consideration, even with respect to a baila, the baila hakohen, which is have them not get married, meaning make her into a penuya, and then not remarry her husband, the kohen, afterwards. They could just live together, not in holy matrimony, because according to the Rambam in Perek Yud Zayin, halacha base of Hilchos Yisuri Biyah, it's a Torah given by Rav Herzog and Rav Avaya Yosef. In an essay about Avkinu Rabban Kiddushim Hineh was mekaving to exactly the same teretz. The Rambam says that there's no malchus for these Yisuri live to a Kohen, which would, you know, include presumably even the Yisuri, the Rabbanon of Shavuya, to a Kohen, and Issa Zona, there'd be no malchus unless it was in a marital relationship. Pahari is not allowed to live with a pniyah altogether. Or you could say it's a case of miyuchedes. All right, we're machmir about miyuchedes that we don't allow pilakshus, but at least you wouldn't have the yisra malchus. Maybe that's what was going on, and that was the harasha. Very, very fascinating answer. And some I saw in the Otsar HaPoskim, he quoted from the Reishis Bikurin, Sefer Reishis Bikurin, another wild possibility that maybe they were relying Meshas Hatchad Godo on the Shita of the Ra'ah. Who's the Ra'ah? He was the Rebbe of the Ritva, right? So the Ritva in Sadav Sam Chesam and Beis in Masechus Kiddushin quotes his Rebbe as being Mekel, as holding that a woman who has relations with a non-Jew is not considered to be a zona, lahalacha. So he asks the question of his Rebbe, he says, but if that's the case, so why do we ask the Shvuya? Shvuya is only because of a chashash that maybe she had relations with a non-Jew. So if you say that she's not really considered to be a zona, so what do you do with that sugya? So he says you'd have to say that all the sugyas in Shas that prohibit a shvuya to a kohen only prohibit the shvuya to a kohen gadol and not to a regular kohen. So in any event, the Ritva himself concludes that his own Rebbe was chozer with respect to the Shita. Nobody really, assumes like the Shita lahalacha at all. Obviously, we're machmer with respect to a woman who has relations with a non-Jew. I mean, not machmer, we assume Igoridin that she's a zone and that she's prohibited to a coin. But every now and then, the Shita of this Rebbe or the Ritva comes up as some sort of a sniff when you have lots and lots of other considerations. So here as well, the Reishis Bikurim says maybe in this extreme situation, or Avkinu Abana Kiddusha Mine, they also relied upon this Havamina of the Rebbe of the Ritva with respect to the status of the Neshei Kohanim. Obviously, that's not going to be enough to get us over the hump. So some explain, based on a Truma Sedesh, and it's quoted by the Chelkas Mechokek in Simon Zion, that if there would be a law on the books that the captor is, just like in a Dine Mamna situation, we say that, I'm in an Ayyadei Mamna situation, if a woman was taken captive, Ayyadei Mamna, because they wanted to collect money, so we say we're not worried that they're going to rape the woman because they don't want to lose the ability to collect the money. So Truma Sedesh says, let's say that they also would face the possible penalty of death in the event that they would rape any of their captors, that their rulers would put them to death, so that also would be a sufficient basis, suggests the Truma Sedeshin. The Chelkas Mechokek is a little uncertain whether we should rely on this, but he quotes the Truma Sedeshin. Perhaps this would be a basis as well to be matir in a Sheik Kohanim in that situation. So all of the poskim will talk about, practically all the poskim will talk about this, say that this is a relevant consideration with the women and with respect to the women in the concentration camps. Because there, the Nazis, they assume, were not allowed to engage in relations to women because they viewed all the Jewish women as cockroaches, as belonging to an inferior race. And they weren't allowed to contaminate their own superior Aryan race with that of the Jewish women, and therefore they were subject to penalty. They could have lost their status, they could have been put into jail, even if they wouldn't have actually been killed. Like in the case of the Truma Sedeshin, the fact that they would would be humiliated, and they would be penalized on some level, and they would be stripped of all of their stature, so that would be a sufficient mirsas that would prevent them from raping the women. And even if they would rape a woman, in the case that they found some sort of hidden secret quarters where they were able to get away with it, then the standard practice was that they would have killed the woman immediately afterwards so as not to get into trouble, and therefore you don't have to worry that this would have happened to any woman. Interestingly enough, Aruch HaShulchan, before the Holocaust even happened, writes in Sif Yud Ches, in Simon Zion, that this is what Shebezeh Samkinim Bizmanenu. He says that this svara, whenever we have captive situations, this is what we rely upon nowadays, that the captors would get into trouble if they would do anything with respect to the captive women, and therefore this is something we have to worry about. And even if, as a matter of, if the law was only on the books for the benefit of the Jewish women, the Nazis presumably wouldn't have cared. The Samarov said, the Samar Rebbe in his Tshuva points out, that this wasn't only for the benefit of the Jewish women, this was for the benefit of the Nazis, that they, for their own benefit, they wanted to show that they're a superior race, that they're not going to mix their blood with that of the Jewish women, and therefore they would have taken this seriously, despite the fact that they could care less about the Jewish women. For their own sake, they would take this very, very seriously. Another svara which is brought by the poskim is the svara of a pesha to a pesha hitir. That let's say you don't know for a fact that this woman was in a particular concentration camp because there are no witnesses to tell you that the woman was in the camp. I mean, this is, I guess, before they knew that there were such scrupulous records taken by the Nazis as to who was in which camp. But if you didn't have the records, it's just a woman comes along and she says, oh yeah, I was in Bergen-Belsen and nobody ever raped me. So since we have the principle of Pesha, so Pesha hit there, so when that's relevant, that could be applied. Now that would only be applicable to the women who are single, Because if there was a, the Radach points out that if it was a married woman and her husband knew that she was in the concentration camp, so already if the husband had a yediyah, so there no longer would be a pesha asu or a pesha yetir. In the cases of the ghettos and the cities, so the post can point out that if there was even a machabua, there was a hiding place where a woman could have gone, and generally speaking, they're assuming that there was some sort of a hiding place, so then one would be allowed to rely upon that as well, that the woman could have gone to the hiding place. Now, the Ramah says something which is in Sif Yud Aleph, which also is a very relevant consideration. The Ramah says that the same is true if the women were always together with other women, because then it's considered like it's like there was like even if those women who they were together with are no longer around, but it's considered as if they always had someone to protect them from being raped, because raping or relations usually occur in close quarters. So if they always were with people, so that itself would also be the equivalent of a machabua, of being in a place where there never was any yichud, and therefore they should be permissible for that reason. So the Mishnah Halachos, so Menashe Klein, goes further on this. And Menashe Klein says, up until now, we've been assuming that all of these women are considered shibuyos, and because they are shibuyos, therefore we have to find some type of a heter for them. But he says, maybe they're not considered to be shibuyos altogether. Because what is a case of shibuya? A case of shibuya is a case where a woman is taken in a private place, where she is alone with the non-Jewish captors. Even in the case of Ir Shekavshua Karkum, when there's a city which is conquered by a conquering army, and there as well, the reason all the women are prohibited is because every single one lives in a separate home, and we're worried that a soldier, each that different soldiers are going to go into different homes and take the women aside in seclusion. But in the case of the Holocaust, he says, well, all the women were together, they were marching together, they were doing hard labor together, they were in the barracks together, and if any woman was removed individually, then that would have been known. Then it can be assumed that if it hasn't been advertised to us or publicized that a particular woman was taken alone on a solitary basis, that we can assume that she always was together with other women. And since she was always together with other women, therefore she never really officially had the status of shibuya altogether. That's what he wants to argue. They never had the status of shibuya altogether. So therefore, he says, that's why there was no real shiloh of the women being able to stay with their husbands kohanim or marrying kohanim after the Holocaust, because it's not that you had to be matari to find the heter for a woman to marry a kohen, because again, based on the considerations of b'shvuyah hekilu, but because there never was a shiloh of shvuyah. So he points out that he knows that there were tshuvas written by Rabbi Yaakov Breish, the Chelkas Yaakov. He knows there were tshuvas written by Dayan Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak. He says that he'll take it seriously because they wrote tshuvas on the subject, but in his opinion, they didn't have to go through all the trouble of finding all of these different heterim, because l'maiseh, the women were not considered to be shvuyas altogether. They also threw into the mix the consideration of the Maharshdam. The Maharshdam has a famous tshuva in which he writes that he thinks a shvuyah is permitted to a kohen nowadays. It's a simon reish lamed hey in the Maharshdam. Why is the Maharshdam? Everyone disagrees with him. The Maharit gave him a very hard time. The Knesset Yecheskel beats him up on this. Bar Hetiv quotes these various shitos in Simon Vav in Eben Ezer. But he wanted to say, nowadays our kohanim, how sure are we that they're kohanim anyway? What we call kohani chazaka. Right? As the Gemara in Ksuvos, Chavdal and Mebeis, talks about the kohani chazaka. They had a conversation with Nechemiah HaTeshasa, who said, "Arei atem necheskoschem, whatever you're considered a kohen for, we'll let you keep your chazaka, but they're not considered to be, kohanim for purposes of doing a vote in the base of Mikdush." So he says, therefore, the Safek kohanim anyway. The Safek kohanim, so I have a Sfek Sfeka. The whole din of Shvuyah is based on what, as the Rambam says, Safek Zona. Sfek Sfeka is generally permitted, right? So if she's the kohen is a Safek kohen, she's a Safek Zona, so therefore, Sfek Sfeka mutter, no problem at all. So they ask her the Maharshdam, they say, well, first of all, we don't say Sfek Sfeka betray gupim, right? One group that we have the Safek about is the man, the other group we have the Safek about is the woman. So how can you say a Sfek Sfeka in a situation like this? Secondly, once Chazal say that Shvuyah is a surah, even if it was based on a sofek, but that becomes an actual issa, like the shachreis and klali sfeik sfeika and simon kuf yud, to get to diverge a little bit to the Yoredea world, at the end of simon kuf yud, so the shach talks about gvinos akum. So gvinos akum, the usher, is a sofek that maybe you use non-kosher ren in order to make it into cheese. But once it was made into an isser, that's because it's considered to be a bada yisser, and if I want to be matir based on a sfeik sfeika, I need a sfeik sfeika besides the fact that it's gvinos akum. I can't say gvinos akum is one sofek, I'm going to find another sofek, Shem Echlifu, and therefore I'm going to be Matzah of the Gvina Sakum. So therefore, one of the critiques of the Marashtam is that you can't say, you know, Sveik Sveika here, you can't use the Shavuya as one of the Sveikas. But not everybody agrees, and some say not everyone agrees with the Shach when it comes to the Gvina Sakum. And Lamaisa, unlike Gvina Sakum, which we weren't Magdir as a Sufik Isser, the Rambam is Magdir, the Isser Shavuya, as an Isser of Sufik Zona. So therefore, maybe you could be more makel over here. Others attack the Marashtam or disagree with the Marashtam, for a different reason, namely the fact that when we say that our Kohanim are Kohanim, they get up and they make a duchim, we let them make brachos, we give them pinyon abein. I mean, we assume that we're birchas Kohanim, we worry that it's a brachal batola, that we assume that our Kohanim are bona fide Kohanim. Even if we're not malah the duchim, at least the malah, you know, for the base of Mikdash, malah lavoda, nonetheless, at least, you know, with respect to everything else, we consider our Kohanim to be Kohanim Vadai. And one should not cast aspersions on the Kohanim nowadays. The Milchus Yitzchak uses it as a consideration. Mishnah Lachos gets very upset about this, and Menashe Klein says, you can't use that as a snip. You can't use that as a consideration. But Lamaisa, you have this argument. Can you use the Marashtam as a snip? Can you not use the Marashtam as a snip? You have it throughout all of Shas, or you have it throughout all of Poskim, with lots of different sugyas in Shas. It comes up all the time, and Lamaisa, a lot of poskim do use it as a sniff, and then they always get rebuked by other poskim saying, "How dare you use it as a sniff?" But you know, this is done all the time. It's kind of like part of the exercise that you can do it, but you have to understand you're going to be attacked for it. So there's a tshuva that from an authority. He was a ger chassid. He lived in Eretz Yisrael. He lived from 1882 to 1953. I checked his biographical information. His name is Rav Tuvia Yehuda Tivyomi. And he wrote Shilos Tshuvas called Eretz Tova. Thank you again, Mordechai, for getting that one. And in his sefer, Eretz Tova, he relies heavily upon this Marashtam. And he goes through the sugyas and he says, look, if you look at the sugyas says, Harei Heim Beches Kosod, the Kohanim Beches Kosod. So with respect to the things that come up every single day, okay, it's a grusha lakoe, and it's a, you know, other types of isurim that apply, it's a gioris lakoe. So those are questions that come up all the time, and of course the Kohanim treat themselves as a Kohani Bade, that these things are awesome because this is part of the chazaka of what people are Kohanim about. But the question of Shvuyah, he says, how often throughout the centuries did the question of Shvuyah present itself? Did it present itself too much? So if he says there was never something Kohanim were moxic themselves as Kohanim when it comes to the Yisr of Shvuyah. So therefore he says, so he thinks that this would be very strong grounds to be Makel. He also had additional grounds of to be Makel in his case, the case that he was dealing with, the woman was in a Bergen-Belsen, but somehow she was under a forged identity. I don't know what she was doing there altogether. She was under forged identity, that she wasn't really Jewish. Therefore, he said that they would have treated her more nicely than they would have treated the others. But interestingly, unlike all the other tshuvos, and he lived, I mean, he just died, whatever, 7-8 years after the Holocaust was over. Unlike all the other tshuvos, he takes it as a double pashut that, of course, the women were violated. All the others say, the women, you know, we can assume they weren't violated because there was mirsas, the Nazis would have been punished, they would have killed the woman who was violated. He assumes the very beginning of his tshuva, he just takes it for granted. He says, yeah, of course, we all know that the women were violated. He's the only one who says it. Very, very interesting. Now, everyone, that's why you have all of these different approaches. Now, Menachas Yitzchak points out, if you take into consideration all of these different spakers of things that you could perhaps rely upon, whether it's Exeus or Strike and the Horosha that the Dafi Moshe mentions in the name of the Trumas Adeshin, whether it's the idea of Mirsas, whether it's the idea of Machbua Achas, what's the idea of Pesha Asua Pesha Hitir, all of these different considerations that, or that the women were always Bitsevis, they were always together with other women. So he says, even if I'm going to require a fake Sfeika beyond the fact that the woman is a Shvuya, so if you combine all these things, so you'll have plenty of Sfeikas, and since we say B'Shvuya Ekilu V'Baran, and it's considered to be an Isser Kal, it's considered to be a Chumra B'Yama Maila Subyuchsin, so under these circumstances, he thinks it's a Dava Pashut, that there would be grounds to be Mekel. Now, in the case of the woman who was taken to the Beis Cholim and taken to the hospital, so Menachas Yitzchak gives different considerations. The Hakka, he says, number one, The case he was dealing with, she was taken to a Russian hospital. He says that the Russians, this is after the war was over, says the Russians were our friends at that point in time. They were the ones who were fighting the Germans. So therefore, that's not considered to be Masur B'yodin. Number two, there was certainly a mirsus because they weren't given carte blanche permission to just violate the Jews who happened to be in the hospital. And number three, and especially in a hospital where presumably the punishment would be greater if you violated a patient. And number three, the chash of Yichud, the Maharik writes, is only if the woman was nisyachta luznus, if the woman was secluded with the non-Jewish man, even if it wasn't for captivity, you're going to be machmir, but it has to be that she allowed herself to be secluded with him for the purpose of being mezana with him, and that certainly, obviously, is not the case. And there's also a Magen Mishnah at the end of Parakeet of Hilkos Yisuri Bia that says that if the woman voluntarily went into a situation, you don't have to worry that she's going to be violated, meaning that she knows what's going on and she has control of her destiny, and certainly she would have been more than happy if she needed to be treated to go into their hospital to be treated. And what about the case where the woman was sheltered by a family during the Holocaust? There's a tshuva by Rav Zev Litki, and under the auspices of Rav Asher Weiss, so he quotes his Rebbe, Rav Asher Weiss, as saying that in such a case, to the extent that Tosfos has this gather, that a woman would have to, even assuming, like the second teretz of Tosfos, that in a yichud situation, a woman could be prohibited, that's only if she's mesur b'yodin, and if clearly if she was like a bas bias, she's not considered to be mesur b'yodin. I will say Tosfos threw in that if she would have the ability to scream out and hear, if she was being sheltered by somebody, she couldn't scream out because she wouldn't want to be discovered. So he says the family would be worried that if they raped her, she would scream out anyway, because that's what somebody does when they get raped. They scream out. And therefore, the Gestapo would hear that there was a commotion in the house. They'd come in running. They discover there's a Jew there, and the family would get into trouble. Not just the Jew would be taken away, but the family that sheltered the Jew, the Jewish woman, would be taken away. So one last point. And that is that, so for based on all these considerations, the poskim were makel, and it goes without saying. One last point is that, let's say, a koi marry a shvuya. What happens to the child? Does the child become a cholo? So the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Zayin Chasif Chav says the child is only a cholo l'chumma, meaning that because a shvuya is only a suffix whether she's a zona or not, we have to be worried that maybe she's not a zona. And if she's not a zona, then the child still has all of the restrictions that apply to Kohanim. The child will not be allowed to marry a grusha or a gioris or be engaged in any relationship that a Kohen wouldn't be allowed to be engaged in. And therefore, there was a shmua that some Rav gave a heter to a son of a Kohen whose mother had been in the concentration camps, gave the heter to that son to say, you are chola and you can marry a grusha. Because you don't have Kedushas Kehuna. So that's against an offer, even if you would say that the woman who went to the Hakos HaShvuyah, and nobody says that, everybody rejects that proposition, but even if you would say such a thing, the child would clearly not be a cholo for purposes of being allowed to marry a Grusha or a Gioris. He wouldn't have the definite Kedushas Kehuna to be Ole Leduchen and to get the first Aliyah, to do Pidyon Abein, but he clearly would not be allowed to marry a Kehenis or a Grusha. I had a conversation with Shachter yesterday about this. Rashefta quoted to me that, he said, sort of a funny case the Avnei Nezer talks about, of a son of a Kohen who married a Chalutza, which is an Issa D'Rabbanan. What if that son wants to marry a Chalutza? So he might say, it's a Mamana Shach. That if he's a Chalol, because a Chalutza is a Surah L'Kohen, B'Torah's Badai, and if that makes him into a Chalol, so then he can definitely marry a chalutza. He can marry anybody who's a suah l'kohen. And if he's not a chalal, because a chalutza doesn't make the child of a kohen who marries a chalutza into a chalal, so he can still marry a chalutza, because the very reason he's not a chalal is because a chalutza, it turns out, is dealing with teres l'kohen. So therefore, he should be able to marry a chalutza as well. So the Avnei Nezer says, no, even though you don't say Riman of Shach when it comes to Isuri Kuna, you have to be machmir in both directions. Anyway, so I pointed out that that shita would be relevant if you were dealing with a woman who is a shvuya. Let's say that we treated a woman from the concentration camp as a shvuya, and a kohen married her, and now the son, who's a kohen, wants to marry a shvuya. Let's say that would be the shilas. It says that in that Avnei Nezer would be relevant. But I pointed out to Shechter, I said that even you don't even need to come to that Avnei Nezer, because since the whole din of a shvuya is suffix zona, so you could say, well, suffix, it could cut in different directions with different women. It could be that the mother was a suffix zona, but really she wasn't a zona. Nothing happened to her, but it could be, and therefore the child's not a chol.
But it could be that this other woman, Shusha Shvuya, really is a zoner because something really did happen to her, and therefore the child would, and therefore this the child who is completely kosher would not be allowed to marry this Shvuya, even though he came from another woman who was a Shvuya, because one Shvuya may have been Mutesi and one Asur, so she had to like that. He said he agreed. So the bottom line is along that we have to conclude with what the Mishnah Halakha says. This idea that we would treat a woman who went through the concentration camp as a shvuya who would be a suah l'kohen is, as some of the posts can point out, our maskara is ishtaka hadavah v'lo yomer, that we have an obligation to figure out why she's mutaris, but there's no question that she's mutaris. There's no question that these women, or these neshei kedushos, these neshei, you know, these neshei mofes, these women who went through, you know, and survived the Holocaust, there's no question that for whatever the reasons, and we gave a whole bunch of reasons to rely upon, that they did not have and do not have, and never will have, the status of a shivuya. I'll just quote the words in the Mishnah Halakos, who went through his own head there to say that they didn't have a din of shvuya altogether, even to, you know, to rely on the kulei shvuya. Says lo ratzisi l'ktov b'zeh l'man kavod benos Yisrael ha-kasheiros. I didn't even want to write about this because of the covenant and the respect that's due to benos Yisrael ha-kasheiros mishpachos ha-chashuvim, and the many many chashuvim mishpachos, including mishpachos kohanim, that emerged in our community in the aftermath of the Holocaust. So I just want to emphasize that Kedushas Yisrael and Kedushas Kahuna Abim Komo Omein, Abiyas Gaal Tzedek Mehem Abiyamein Omein. Amen.